This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, is it time to make the U.S. House of Representatives bigger? The number of representatives has stayed the same for a century while the population keeps growing. A new bill aims to change that. We'll check out the pros and cons of the idea. Now, newly released assessments from the U.S. Department of Energy and the FBI have found some degree of likelihood that the COVID-19 pandemic was the result of a leak from a Chinese lab. This is FBI Director Christopher Wray Tuesday speaking on Fox News.
The FBI has for quite some time now assessed that the origins of the pandemic are most likely a potential lab incident in Wuhan.
But hang on, four other U.S. intelligence agencies reportedly still think the evidence points to a natural start to the pandemic, while two others remain undecided on the source. Most assessments have a low degree of confidence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important do you think it is to find out how the pandemic got started? What questions or concerns do you have about the politics over the argument over how it got started? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Engber is senior editor at The Atlantic. Daniel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, you wrote a piece, "The Lab Leak Will Haunt Us Forever," is the headline. Can you explain what you mean by that?
What I mean by that, unfortunately, is that this is not something that's going to be resolved anytime soon. As you mentioned in your introduction, this intelligence assessment from eight different intelligence agencies plus the National Intelligence Council, I mean, this is, a year and a half after it was first conducted, and we're still in a state of very low confidence. So only one of those intelligence elements was willing to say something with, quote, moderate confidence. That was the FBI. But all the rest either said, we just have no idea, or we are making a low confidence judgment. So I think in light of that, and in light of the fact that, you know, no real substantive further studies of this question are being done, basically due to China's unwillingness to participate, I just think we're going to be in the state of uncertainty for the foreseeable future.
The Department of Energy statement, or actually not a statement, it was kind of leaked, in effect, their conclusion. The FBI statements have gotten a lot of attention with people saying, aha, lab leak. Can you talk about, though, who is saying and what they're saying about the natural transmission concept?
Right. So, yeah, sure. This leaked update to the Department of Energy's assessment that came out over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal had the scoop. So the Department of Energy originally is that we just don't know. We looked into it. We can't tell. There's not enough information here. They've since updated that for reasons that are unclear. That has not been leaked. We don't know what new intelligence there was or new reasoning was used, but they've now switched over to saying with low confidence that some kind of laboratory accident might have been responsible. I should just clarify again that all of these intelligence agencies agree that this was not a Chinese bioweapon.
Right.
The idea that's on the table is more that, you know, this is potentially an experiment that went wrong. This was a virus harvested from a bat cave that, you know, ended up infecting someone in the lab who then spread it to the community, something along those lines. Not a, you know, a biological weapon. In any case, you know, this is still, even though with the Department of Energy sort of changing its vote, as it were, to low confidence lab leak, there's still four agencies that say, no, this is, you know, probably the conventional story for pandemic pathogens. And even for the first SARS pandemic in 2003, this is something that spread in the wild from one animal to another to humans and then was spread, you know, likely from a marketplace. So that idea, if you just go by the numbers from this intelligence assessment, it's still, you know, five of these agencies said it's probably a market origin. And now two have gone the other direction. And you could just compare it. I mean, there's news, a similar kind of assessment was done of Havana syndrome, the idea that State Department employees were targeted by a Russian energy weapon. And so I'm bringing this up just because the news just came out that yesterday, I think, that the assessment from the seven intelligence agencies came back, and one of them couldn't decide, and six of them said, this is definitely not a Russian energy weapon. So I'm just, I think that's a useful contrast. I noticed it yesterday. Like, that's a case where the intelligence assessment is pretty uniform versus, and pretty high confidence compared to this COVID origins thing, where it's just kind of like, eh, most of them say it's probably the market, but a couple don't, and no one really knows.
Talking to Daniel Engber for The Atlantic, he wrote about the latest findings on the possible origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Daniel, I think one thing everybody agrees on, at least everybody outside the borders of China, is China could do a lot more when it comes to transparency to help get to the bottom of these things. How much is that hindering assessments like this?
I mean, it's just hindering it enormously. I would say fatally hindering it. In order to resolve this stuff, the incredible work has been done already. Mike Warraby and colleagues have published a series of papers making a very compelling case for this market origin. They've shown, at the very least, that the first major outbreak was at that market. Most of the early cases were either people who visited the market or who lived in the vicinity of the market. So, you know, that's generally agreed upon. We just don't know for absolute certain that the first infection was at that market or the beginning of the outbreak in Wuhan. So there has been really useful work that has advanced the story. It's not like no progress has been made. Evidence has mounted for the market origin, for example, and there have been drips and drabs of information about the kind of research that was happening at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is thought to be one of the places that may have spawned a putative lab leak. On the other hand, to really get to the bottom of it, well, you'd want to have access to whatever testing was done on animals that were sold at the Huanan market in Wuhan. You'd want to have more complete audits of the various labs in Wuhan that were doing research on bat coronaviruses. There's a bunch of things you'd want to have. Now, the World Health Organization made a plan to follow up on its original formal inquiry into COVID origins and return to China and do some of this work. And this, you know, China has now refused. And so I understand that there are still some kind of attempted negotiations here, but it does not seem likely that this is going to happen anytime soon. The issue has become so politicized. You know, some Chinese scientists point the finger in the other direction and say, oh, well, maybe this is came from frozen foods, frozen fish that originated in the West. So at this point, on the international scale, it has become such a political hot potato that it just seems very unlikely that this kind of research that would be helpful is going to be done anytime soon.
And you write that whichever side people lean to, there's a big coincidence that they say has to be explained away. If you like the, you know, the natural transmission, people can say, well, wait, this Wuhan lab just happened to be researching similar stuff. If you go for lab leak, wait, this market just happened to have all these animals where the first transmissions happened. How big a deal is the coincidence that's going to be there, whichever answer ends up being right?
I mean, I really think it comes down to people's inclinations on what to believe are really, I found in my reporting and even just conversations with friends and family about this. It's just what sort of coincidence are you drawn to? For some people, you just can't get past the fact that here's this lab with this, you know, this researcher who's known for studying these bat coronaviruses, who's known for studying the very type of a pathogen that led to this outbreak. And lo and behold, of all the cities in the world for this thing to break out, it's, you know, some miles from that lab. How could that be a coincidence? And then on the other hand, this market, as you said, this is a place that was known to have been selling wild animals as recently as 2019. This is a place where people who have visited it in, you know, the recent pre-pandemic past had the thought, this is the kind of place where a pandemic could start. This is exactly the way in which the first SARS pandemic is thought to have started. What are the odds if this really came from a you know, research lab? What are the odds that things would play out so that it would look so much like the first SARS pandemic, or it would look so much like what you would expect from a natural, what they call zoonotic transmission from an animal, you know, outside of a lab? So I, you know, those are sort of unresolvable. I don't want to pretend that those are, that one can't have a reasonable discussion of the evidence on both sides. I mean, certainly you could add in the fact that almost every pandemic we know of started the same way, not from a lab leak. So even if you just applied that as your, you know, your first filter, well, let's go with what you would most expect based on history, known history, right? If you have these two coincidences, that would push you towards the one that fits with everything you would have expected prior to, you know, 2020. By identifying the two coincidences, I don't mean to say that they're necessarily on equal footing mm-hmm. as a matter of like which is more likely. But I do think it's, you know, the human mind is drawn to this kind of reasoning, and whichever thing turns out to be the truth, there is still one mega coincidence that we just have to make peace with.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Engber is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He joined us with the latest look at what we know about the origins of COVID-19. Up next, we'll talk to UW-Madison professor of pathology and lab medicine about what we still have to learn, what we may never know, how we track the progress of viruses like this in the first place. You could join in with your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about COVID-19, its origins, and dueling national intelligence assessments as to whether it came from natural transmission from an animal or from some kind of mistake at a lab in China. You can join in as we talk to a UW researcher who's been following the disease from the early days. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Dave O'Connor is a UW Medical Foundation professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the challenges of trying to figure out where a disease like COVID-19 started?
Daniel did an outstanding job in summarizing this in the previous segment, but I think I would just add to it that you're operating in a fog of war very early on in a pandemic. There's not complete information. And as he mentioned, we probably will never get complete information out of China. That makes it very difficult to draw firm conclusions. I think that scientists are swayed by data, and we have more data in favor of the natural origin in the market. Whereas the lab leak has some information in favor of it, but it's largely circumstantial, and a lot of the information seems to be classified. So it's harder to assess because we just don't know as much about it.
Is this an important question to answer in your mind?
Well, I think it's important because we have to learn from history, and we have to learn from our mistakes, and we have to be better prepared next time. And if we don't try to get a firm understanding of what happened at the source this time, we'll be poorly prepared next time.
When it comes to labs, even if it turns out this wasn't a lab leak incident, are there things you'd hope we could look at and say, okay, well, in future, we don't want that to happen. Here are things we could do to even heighten our already high levels of caution at places that research potentially dangerous diseases?
I think the possibility that the lab leak is still a possibility at this stage means that as scientists, we need to do some self-reflection. We need to ask what research that's done in the name of pandemic preparedness itself carries risk, and what sort of regulations need to be in place to minimize that risk. As David Wallace Wells noted in the New York Times this week, there's still a shockingly low level of coordinated regulation around the world on research that brings in bats or monkeys and tries to understand the viruses that infect them. And without that kind of regulation, it's difficult to know all the work that's being done. And there are some holes in those regulations, like they apply only to federally funded research that could reasonably be closed to make the work that does get done safer and more transparent.
Now, early in the COVID pandemic, you and some of your colleagues, I believe, were doing genetic research to track strains of the disease as they emerged and to see where they're spreading and how. I mean, can we do a genetic family tree and hopefully trace back the origin of a disease like this?
Well, and that's exactly what we have for the market origin. If this were CSI Wuhan, we have a pattern in that previous outbreaks started the same way. We have crime scene photos and that we have mammals in the market that could have housed the virus. And we have the DNA evidence. We have SARS-CoV-2 genetic material from environmental swabs that were taken at the market. That's why a lot of scientists believe that the natural origin is the most likely, is because we have exactly that kind of data from the market. And we have an enigmatic research program in a nearby lab where there might well be data, but it's not publicly available. Scientists can't scrutinize it. And I would hope that eventually that data will become more widely available so that the quality of the evidence could be compared and weighed against the quality of the natural origin evidence.
Talking to Dave O'Connor, professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the difficult search for the ultimate origin of COVID-19, the virus that causes it. Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. And I'll point out two things quickly relating to China. There's a sad point in their propaganda, because not only were they blaming frozen food at one point, but they also decided to blame a military base in Maryland for as the supposed origin of COVID at one point. And I'm pretty sure the spread of COVID is not traced from there, even inside the U.S. But the sad point I was going to get to is there was a doctor by the name of Li Wenliang, I'm probably saying that wrong, who actually discovered COVID early on when he was treating patients for it, and he died, but he had been told by the police officials in that province to basically keep his mouth shut when he tried raising an alarm about it. And there are two articles in the BBC about this. The doctor who died was in a 2020 article called Coronavirus Kills Chinese Whistleblower Doctor.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. I want to jump in and bring our guest in on that. Nate pointing toward some efforts of the Chinese government that may have obfuscated our ability to track the early days of the spread of COVID.
Well, this is one of the great unknowns about the lab leak theory. And it's an unknown that, coming from Wisconsin, I don't have any particular insight into. But if you do believe in a lab leak theory, you also have to have some blind faith that accompanies many conspiracies, that you have this massive number of people who would have had to have known and who would have had to have remained silent in order for the conspiracy to hold up and for it not to have had a whistleblower leak it. And that's a little bit hard to imagine given the scope, but in an authoritarian government, it has happened before. There was a smallpox outbreak in what's now Kazakhstan in 1971 that was only discovered decades later. So the idea that you could have this kind of large conspiracy that could hold up for years has precedent. And I think if you buy into the idea that there could be a conspiracy that is trying to obfuscate a lab origin, you have to entertain other possibilities. And maybe I just read too much Tom Clancy and Mark Greene, but you could imagine something like a lab leak could also be, people who are involved in that. Maybe you plant evidence at a market. I'm not saying that that happens, but once you start considering a conspiracy, you have to be open-minded to the different ways in which that could have manifested itself. And unfortunately, the problem with all of that conspiratorial thinking is there's just no publicly available evidence that we can use to assess its veracity, to assess how the strength of the evidence compares to what we know about the market.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nate. Dave, I'm a layperson. I'm not a scientist. I have no inside knowledge. A couple years ago, if you asked me about the likely origin, my guess would be likely natural transmission, but you can't rule out the lab leak completely. And if you asked me that question today, I think I'd give roughly the same answer. I don't know. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I think we still need more evidence. And I think that there are a lot of scientists, myself included, who are open-minded. I think it's important to restate something that Daniel said at the beginning of the half hour, which is that there is no evidence that this was man-made, that in some way, shape, or form, this virus jumped from animals to people, but from exactly which animals to exactly which people first is still something that we need to figure out and need more information in order to draw firmer conclusions about.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Dave, as I recall, Chinese scientists initially did share a genetic workup of some of the early strains of the virus that causes COVID-19. That's part of what gave a head start to vaccine efforts in the United States. So that kind of cooperation is at least hypothetically possible. Would you hope that the Chinese scientific community would be allowed to open up and cooperate with the rest of the world?
Oh, absolutely. But I think even at the time, the Chinese scientists who did that, that was somewhat controversial within China. And I think that what you're hitting on is the fact that there's always going to be some thumbs on the scale of science. And that's something that we need to work on, not just as scientists, but as part of a global community, because these sorts of viruses are going to emerge in the future. They're going to emerge from different parts of the world in the future. And we have to make sure that we try not to blame the places where the first cases are identified, because that's going to be, frankly, counterproductive. All it's going to do is make countries not want to share this data, when in fact we need as much transparency as possible.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dave O'Connor, UW Medical Foundation Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at what we know and don't know about the start of COVID-19. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a look at some of the latest medical technology, including efforts to use machine learning and so-called artificial intelligence to detect and cure health problems. Join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8. That's here on the Ideas Network. How much would you pay for a football jersey? If you said $1.2 million, well, you probably didn't say that, but someone did. As reported by ESPN, a piece of sports history was auctioned off for just over $1.2 million. It was the jersey worn by quarterback Joe Montana for the San Francisco 49ers when they won the Super Bowl in 1985 and when they won again 4 years later. Yes, he wore the same jersey in both Super Bowls. Hopefully it got washed somewhere in between. Now, I don't have that kind of money to throw around for sports memorabilia, but I do have one that I keep around. When I was a kid, my uncle was working at a restaurant when Detroit Tigers pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich came in. My uncle got an autographed baseball for me. I still keep it by my desk at home. I'm guessing the sale value wouldn't come anywhere close to $1 million, but that's okay. I'm not selling. Sports news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, should America's farmers use their land to feed the country or supply power to it? What if they could do both? This week, Jen White is hosting 1A from California's San Joaquin Valley to hear from all sides of that debate and to hear more about where solar power is headed next. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now let's talk about a magic number in American politics. 435. That's the number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's been the number for over 100 years. With one little brief wiggle when Alaska and Hawaii became states, we quickly resettled on 435. But the population of the U.S. has gone up over that time from 92 million in 1910 to 331 million in the latest census. So congressional districts have gotten a lot larger. A bill in Congress would boost the number of representatives. Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon wants to add 150 seats after the next census and some more after that. It's not likely to pass, but why have we settled on 435? Is it worth adding some seats? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is it time to embiggen the House of Representatives? What do you like or not like about that idea? And do you have questions about why things are the way they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Smith joins us now. He's the Kate M. Gregg Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Washington University. He's written a number of books on American politics and Congress. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning. What does the Constitution say about how we figure out how many representatives we have?
It leaves most of this to Congress, but it says that every 10 years we have a census. The Constitution requires that decennial census, and it requires then that representatives in the House of Representatives be apportioned to the states in a fashion that reflects that most recent census. Then it says that no state shall have more than one representative for every 30,000 people, and each state gets at least one representative, that is, whatever its size. So the Constitution was, of course, written at a time when we had maybe up to 13 states, and 30,000 seemed to be about the right number. It created a House of Representatives in the first Congress with 65 members.
I ran the numbers. If we did 30,000 per district now, we'd have a Congress, a House of just over 11,000 representatives. Seems a little unwieldy.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, this ran into controversy pretty early on. You wrote on your Substack a while back that even the founders kind of disagreed over how to implement that basic guideline in the Constitution.
Well, they sure did. 30,000 is a nice round number, but it hardly ever divides evenly into the size of a state's population. So from the very beginning, the contending forces in American politics argued about how to deal with fractions. Alexander Hamilton had one point of view. Thomas Jefferson had another point of view. At the start, Congress adopted the Hamilton version, which basically said that if your state has the largest fraction, you get the next representative, and so on. Jefferson had a somewhat different formula. Turned out that President George Washington agreed with Jefferson and cast his very first veto of that congressional legislation, which was then written with the Jefferson plan, a somewhat more complicated plan, in mind. Politics was central to this from the start because the Jefferson plan allowed Virginia to get one more representative under his plan than under the Hamilton plan. And politics has infused the decision about what method to use for apportioning districts to states ever since.
Now, before we dig into the argument of whether to go past 435, why did we lock in just over a century ago on this magic number, 435?
For politics again. early in the century, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the United States was growing very rapidly. We had a very large number of immigrants. There was a fairly large transfer of Americans, especially Black Americans, from the South to the North. And this filled northern urban areas, which became more and more industrial. And so the population became more and more northern and industrial. Republicans and rural political interests disliked this change and thought that reapportioning seats or continuing to increase the number of seats in the House of Representatives would only give a bigger and bigger advantage to the North. So what happened was they decided first not to reapportion and not to increase or change the size of the House. Between 1789 and 1910, the House had increased in size every 10 years as the country grew.
talking to Steve Smith from Washington University about the idea of increasing the size of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, one argument that made by the sponsor of this bill I mentioned and others is, okay, 1910, again, I checked the numbers, it was about 200,000 people per district. You have a chart on that Substack article I mentioned. Now we're knocking on the door of 800,000. So four times as many people represented by this same number of Congress folks in effect. Does this make them in some way less representative, do you think?
Well, that certainly is the primary argument for increasing the size of the House. Right now, the average district size is about 700,000 or 765,000, and we're going to be reaching a million here in a couple of decades. So if you think that having some personal contact with your legislator is important, and that the lower house, the House of Representatives of Congress, is the one place in federal government where you can have that, then you'd have to admit that having districts that approach a million are just way too large for having that kind of contact. Of course, the geographic size of districts really is not changing because we have not added states and states are not growing geographically. But the mix of political and economic and social interests in states and districts, of course, become more complex. And there's a good argument that a representative cannot get to know those people and those interests when those districts' populations are so large.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to hear this topic. It's something I agree with. I'd love to see a more significant increase. The question I have is, if we increase the amount of representatives, thereby lowering the population that each representative represents, does that make it more difficult to gerrymander legislative districts?
Interesting question, Nick. What do you think, Steve?
Well, the gerrymandering, of course, is a function of state politics. And I will trust my state politicians to continue to pursue their partisan and political interests, no matter how many seats there are assigned to a state. So I don't think it gets rid of gerrymandering. There's plenty of gerrymandering already in state legislative contests or seats. So I'd expect congressional gerrymandering to continue. Now, it does mean that it might be a little bit easier to draw some district lines and to keep districts looking kind of normal, where they're not odd shapes, where all the parts of the district are sort of contiguous to each other. Certainly easier to get around those districts. But the gerrymandering, I don't think that'll end.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. Steve, what would have to happen to increase the size of the House? There's a bill. Does that mean this is just normal legislation? If somehow it passed Congress, signed by the president, boom, we've got more representatives?
Yeah. It's not any more complicated than that. During the period between 1789 and the 19-teens, Congress every 10 years would revisit this question and would take into account the expected growth in population and set a new number that reflected that growth. It was regular legislation. Now, there were politics to that legislation, as you can imagine. It wasn't always easy to get that legislation enacted. Partisan divisions between the House and the Senate and the president oftentimes got in the way. But yes, that's all it takes is a regular piece of legislation signed by the president.
Talking to Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the U.S. House of Representatives, why it has exactly 435 members, even as the U.S. population keeps growing, and the pros and cons of a proposed law, a long shot, that would add a bunch of seats to the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we add seats to the House of Representatives? What do you think the benefits could be? What worries would you have? What questions do you have about the political impact and some of the history behind this? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with political scientist Steve Smith from Washington University in St. Louis, looking at a bill in Congress that would add 150 seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. It's a long shot, it looks like. We're finding out why the House has stuck with 435 seats for over 100 years, even as the population has grown a lot. You can join in with your thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, I assume, like, if I'm a member of a political party, I would worry that increasing the number of members of the House, you know, will it hurt my side or help my side? Big states, small states might ask the same kind of questions. Who potentially could win or lose by increasing the size of the House?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is just a little complicated. Obviously, the most obvious interest at stake is the interest of the very smallest states. You know, Wyoming, with roughly 550,000 people, gets one representative, even though the average size of a House district is now approaching 770,000. So a state like Wyoming will lose arithmetically. Its one representative will end up becoming a smaller fraction of the total House if the large states gain a lot more seats as the overall size of the House increases. So there would be some opposition, I think, from small states. But you can imagine these new districts would be much smaller. So it's likely, for example, that the district lines would line up with local units of government, like county or city lines, a little bit better than they do now. It's possible that we'll have more districts that are really dominated by some minority interest. We'll have more Black districts. We'll have more Latino districts. And it could be that in some of these districts, a third or a fourth party, a minor party, might actually be more popular than the two major parties. So as you shrink those districts, it creates the possibility that these geographically concentrated interests in our politics will gain some formal representation in Congress, and the major parties might not like that. And of course, there are the current incumbents in the House of Representatives. They might prefer to be one of 435 than one of, say, 650. So their power would be diluted. And of course, in order to get the bill passed, we have to get a majority of those incumbent members to support the idea. So there's all kinds of sources of opposition, but many sources of support for this kind of thing.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I would just like to bring up the fact that the general public should be getting the same benefits as far as health care and et cetera that the House of Representatives gets. And if you add another 150 House members, that's going to be a heck of a zap to the budget, if you ask me.
Jeff, thanks for the call. The cost of not just the members of the House, but the additional staff per member of House, Steve.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are real costs to doing this. But, you know, to be honest, the cost of running Congress, while a substantial sum of money, is peanuts in comparison with the size of the federal budget. So I don't think that can be our dominant concern. I think we have to worry about the quality of our democracy first. And when we decide what's best for the democracy, we ought to be willing to pay for it. But there are a number of considerations. The House chamber is already bursting at the seams. Of course, members there do not get individual seats or desks. They just crowd into the chamber. They have office space. An additional office building would have to be put up. And as you say, they need to be staffed if they're going to do a good job of their representation. So sure, there are real costs. There's no doubt about that.
Thanks for the call. One thing we don't talk much, Steve, about the job of being in Congress or on a congressional staff is constituent services, which is a lot of things. And I have seen concerns that given the size of the districts, the population of districts, I should say, that are being represented, that they're just overwhelmed. Can you talk about that side of the job that isn't always in the limelight?
Well, that's right. On Capitol Hill, it's usually called casework. It's where a constituent brings a personal problem, oftentimes with an executive or a federal agency. Maybe they want their son or daughter to get early release from the armed services because a parent recently passed away, and the family farm would go under if they don't get more help. A member of Congress might be called in to help them make the arrangements. Or someone has a problem with their Social Security check. They have someone on Capitol Hill to go to. Members of Congress spend a lot of time doing that. And they are struggling with this because their staffs have been essentially capped in size. The office budgets really have not grown much now for a couple of decades. And so personal staff has been pretty well fixed, even though the size of the population and the amount of casework they're expected to do has increased. Increase the number of members, it is certainly the case that constituents would have better access to members and their staff. And depending upon how much staff support we allow members of Congress to have, it could very well be that casework service will be improved.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering about if your plan might include having districts cross state borders. So maybe you follow the population instead of just figuring, okay, well, we have to cut it off here because the state border is here.
Dennis, thanks for the call. As I understand it, Steve, we can't do that.
Well, not according to the Constitution. We can amend the Constitution, but that's a mighty lift. The Constitution does allocate House seats to the states. How the states choose to elect them is pretty much up to them, subject to quite a variety of federal and court regulations. There is another kind of twist to this. The current interest in increasing the size of the House stems in part from a group of reformers who would like to see the House move to proportional representation. So that the parties received seats in the House within a state in proportion to the number of votes they received. Supporters of proportional representation would like to increase the number of seats. Wisconsin has 10 seats, but if Wisconsin, say, had 15 seats, it could divide those seats among more parties or more directly in proportion to the votes. So there is a kind of a hidden agenda, actually not so hidden, among some reformers who would like to see us move to proportional representation and have the membership of the House then better reflect the proportionate support for the parties in the general public.
One quick clarification, 10 electoral votes in Wisconsin, 8 congressional seats.
Ten electoral votes, yeah, sorry.
Which brings me to, if we change the number of representatives, that affects the Electoral College, right?
Well, it would. If the Electoral College constitutional provisions were not changed, increasing the number of seats in the House would automatically increase the number of electoral votes that a state would receive. Now, remember, the seats in the House would still be allocated to the states, apportioned to the states according to their population. So the relative balance in the Electoral College across the states wouldn't change a lot. The one change that's obvious is for the very smallest states, which receive 3 electoral votes, one for their representative and one for each of their 2 senators. So they get 3 no matter their size. That might still be the case, but 3, if we increase the size of the House, 3 would be a smaller part of the whole.
And briefly, Steve, hey, what about the Senate? That's, 2 per state as things stand right now. Anybody thinking about changing that in any way?
Well, people think about it, but then they read the Constitution and they see that it provides for 2 senators per state. And then the Article 5 actually says you can't even amend that. Well, there's some legal dispute about whether it's truly unamendable, but it's pretty clear that it would be far, far tougher to change the membership of the Senate than the membership of the House.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Oh, great to be with you. Have a good day.
You too. That's Stephen Smith, professor of social sciences and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He joined us for a look at the size of the House of Representatives and what it would take to add more members to the House. There's still time for you to weigh in on that idea. Do you think the House of Representatives needs to be bigger so that district sizes, populations are smaller? Do you think that would make things more representative? Or do you worry about the impact of something like that? Let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how old do you feel? And how does that compare to your actual calendar age? In a lot of surveys, people consistently say they feel younger than their age. Find out why and share your answers as we talk about some of the latest research. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll take a look at the unique flavors and dishes of Ukrainian food. We've got a Ukrainian-American cookbook author joining the show with us tomorrow. If this is the food you grew up with or you've encountered it, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a new immigration rule from the Biden administration would add restrictions for people seeking asylum at the U.S. border. Some advocates for immigrants say it looks a lot like Trump-era policies. We'll look at the proposal and what it would mean for immigration enforcement. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.